Hi, this is Zero, and you're listening to A Dark Companion, a Haunting Melissa and Dark Hearts podcast. Tonight, I'm doing a bit of a solo episode, talking about Chapter 18, called Asking Questions. This is one of my favorite chapters, especially for the exchange between Melissa and Dr. Carraway, which I will get to in a moment. So I'm going to be looking at what I have written on itwantstogetout.tumblr.com, a blog dedicated to Haunting Melissa and Dark Hearts, and right now especially dissecting every little bit of Dark Hearts that I can. So this episode, this chapter, chapter 18, Asking Questions, the portal for this chapter is the same kind of circle, but we've got some creepy fingers coming out of the sides of that, so we all associate that with Goth Girl or Karis. And inside the portal, we've got a blurry image of two people, one wearing a very iconic hat, and we'll find out who they are as we get into the chapter. The quote I pulled for this chapter is, "Sometimes I'm so afraid, I feel like I can't live anymore." That's said by Melissa. The characters that appear in this chapter, there's Melissa, there's Jack, there's someone that you see sometimes, and sometimes you don't see them. Somebody that Jack is on the phone with, and I've got some ideas about that based on the way that the episode is cut. Mrs. Carraway, and some new jackbooted needle thug guy, henchman, that appears at the end of the episode. So, looking at this episode, it starts out with Melissa kind of coming to in that same chair that her mother was always sitting in, locked in that room, trying to battle these demons that are giving her a hard time. And we've got that key imagery again. And, you know, opening doors, unlocking things. It's, you know, a constant theme throughout. And she's also clutching a cross, which is another thing very reminiscent of her mother, and likely, you know, kind of a way to try to ground yourself, you know, with something that's, you know, kind of the opposite of these dark forces that seem to be acting upon her and working against her. When she goes to her bedroom and sits on the bed, pulls out her laptop, this is a place where you'll see a dynamic story element. One of the great, great things in this movie. And if you haven't seen it, watch it again. Also, listen out for the soundtrack. There are some kind of audio cues that'll help you recognize when there's definitely something to pay attention to. Something might change. Next to Melissa, and we can see that Goth Girl is sitting next to her in bed, and Melissa doesn't look at her, but can kind of sense that she's there, and kind of cut short her whatever she was going to do on the computer, and decides to kind of just run out. And when she runs out, Jack is on the phone with somebody talking about how Melissa's starting to ask a lot of questions. And the way that the scene goes, it goes right to Carraway's office, and she's looking pretty freaked out and looking at her phone. And I don't know if that is to imply that Jack is the one that called her, or that, you know, Jack was on the phone with her at least, or is this just more of Carraway dreading whatever it is she needs to do and getting these phone calls from the visitor and weird things going on. I mean, her office is weird enough. There's the sound of at least three clocks. There's ticking, there's the gong going off for the alarm, and there's like a lot of clock sounds in her office. And I wonder if that's to kind of give us the mental picture of her being on some kind of schedule, or that it's time for something that she's supposed to do. I am very curious as to what the key in the opening, what that key goes to. You know, is it purely symbolic, or is there something that she'll discover that will, you know, that she'll be able to open, you know, something that's obviously meant for her to see? I don't know. But the exchange on the street, and it's come up a few times on the podcast, between Caraway and Melissa. Melissa's now in this state. Well, first off, her clothing. She's dressed like she's going to a funeral. She's wearing black and just very dark compared to who she was before, which seems to be pretty in line with the way her character's developing. And she's really freaked out, kind of starting to lose it. And I use kind of very lightly. But if you watch Melissa throughout the whole scene, and you know, I've found talking to Neil and everybody involved that this was likely just a coincidence of editing, but still effective, is that you really get the sense that she's starting to lose it, because throughout the whole exchange on the street, she never blinks. And I went back and watched it several times just to make sure I didn't miss anything, but she's really freaked out. And she startles Caraway as Caraway comes out of her office. And Caraway does what anyone would do and kind of turns around quickly, like she's freaked out, but then immediately turns away and starts walking very stone-faced, almost like she's playing a part. Like she knew this was going to happen, and since she's not facing Melissa, she doesn't need to keep up the act of being kind of freaked out by her. And Melissa brings up Jane, and that what happened to Jane was in a local paper. I believe she also mentions that it was 7 years ago, and that wherever Jane lives was a couple hundred miles away. So we've got, you know, further confirmation that this Dark Hearts mystery extends beyond Upton, Kansas, and that other families are involved. And you know, I wonder how the visitor is choosing who he works with or against. You know, the Lancasters made a deal of some sort to turn their life around. And I don't know if the Strogues made a similar kind of deal. I mean, does the visitor, does he just work in making deals, kind of a devil at the crossroads kind of thing? And in exchange for whatever it is that you want, the Lancasters had to take in Adam and keep an eye on him and, I guess, just make it so that he can do whatever it is that he's supposed to do. So if deals are his thing, what kind of deal did the Strokes make? Or, you know, the rest of the Maynard House gang? I know that Karis kind of tricked them, lies like she always does, about them getting powers like she has. You know, necrotizing fasciitis for the math teacher and messing up Mike Cole pretty bad. But did that deal have anything to do with the visitor? Or was this something purely out of Karis's mind? And perhaps, maybe Karis made a deal with the visitor, and part of that is roping in these other people to do whatever rituals they did, and bring about this creature that you can see on that wall painting, and, you know, that we saw in the shed. I mean, that, to me, it's definitely the same thing. And so, yeah, since that's the same being, same entity being brought over, one by Adam in whatever ritual he did with that robot, and whatever ritual that the Maynard House gang did with sacrificing animals and eating their hearts. So I can only imagine that the whatever horrible thing that Adam was chopping up in his room and then kind of shoved pieces of into the kind of mangled version of the robot, it's pretty clear that Adam must have eaten the heart as well. But you still wonder where Adam came from, and I mean, he was creepy to start with. Before he even, you know, got in the shed and did his thing, he was already weird. So I really wonder where the visitor got him. And, you know, now that he's brought the shrub guy, the Groot of all evil, now that he's brought him over to this side, what's the purpose? I mean, does he just hang out in that shed the whole time? Or is there, I mean, is that even the same weird monster? Maybe there's more than one of them. And, you know, when they bring them over, where do they go? Because, you know, and clearly at the Maynard house, they brought him over. They brought him through whatever veil he's behind, whatever other dimension he's in. But you don't see him around. Well, you do see him around behind Jack when he goes to look into Melissa's bedroom. And there's a great DSE of him, it, I don't know what to call it, floating behind him. And then also in chapter 15, when Melissa's back in the chair in her mother's room, and she starts kind of changing, throwing her head around and thrashing, and there's kind of these shrub-like sticks, things that are kind of replacing and pushing out of her face. So it's kind of like that thing comes over. I guess it just has to come over and over again. But, you know, what does it do when it's here? What's the purpose of bringing it across? And that's something hopefully we'll get some more answers to as we start digging through things. But yeah, back to Melissa and Caraway on the street and Melissa's clothing. And this speaks directly to the timeline trickery post I made on the blog, just about trying to figure out when things happened, and also kind of, you know, which Melissa are we seeing? Now, the clothing change is a big signal that the Melissa we're seeing is not the same as the Melissa we saw in Haunting Melissa, where she was wearing plaid and jeans. Now she's wearing dark clothes and her hair's a bit different. So it's very curious where things line up in the timeline. It's not as linear as maybe it seems. So you've really got to pick through things and try to place events on a certain timeline to get an idea of when things happened that Melissa can't remember. Because you're not really sure, because obviously since she can't tell us, she can't remember what it is that happened. And we have the time that was missing between Haunting Melissa and Dark Hearts, which certainly seems like that's the time that she can't remember. But is there more? Don't really know. And also, I mean, that scene at the end of Haunting Melissa at the ATM machine camera, and then she disappears in that kind of portal flash of light. We don't necessarily know when that happened. It doesn't really have to be between Haunting Melissa and Dark Heart. We could be seeing that, especially in this kind of episodic delivery that this movie has, that could have been at any point in time. It's kind of isolated. We'll have to look deeper into that and find out. So after Melissa confronts Caraway on the street and doesn't really seem to get anywhere, because Caraway's not letting up at all, and it sounds like Caraway was convincing Jane that she was crazy, just like she seems to be really pushing on Melissa, you know, that it's all in your head and, you know, you've got issues and maybe you should see a doctor. Kind of drilling that in her head, kind of a way of steering her off course. So when Melissa gets home, and she's parked outside, and she's saying a quick prayer that she can't really even seem to finish. She's really extra freaked out at that point. And goes inside and sees Jack. Now this is, especially if you listen to the audio cues, there is a little sound you get as the door opens that you should definitely keep your eyes peeled. There's a DSC in the room with Jack that I didn't see for a while. And it's so obvious. It's very clear once you see it, and you really realize, how did I not see that? Like, I looked right through that several times. Must have been. And you'll notice that there is a correlation between some of the DSCs within a chapter, that if you see, especially if there's more than one, if you see a particular DSC in the beginning, you may not see the one in the end. It's kind of, after you go through it several times, a way for you to know, oh, this is the version I'm seeing, this is what's happening. And take into account that these DSCs are not just ways of freaking you out by changing something. They could very well be part of the story. Like, there's a reason that the visitor shows up in the bedroom with Jack, just standing there, and she doesn't see him. And I assume Jack knows he's there. Especially with what happens when Melissa runs to her room, closes the door, and the door flies back open, and there's this henchman kind of guy who grabs her and injects her in the neck. Now, depending on which version of this chapter you're seeing, when she's looking up and her vision's fuzzy, she's being looked down upon by the henchman, sometimes by the henchman and the visitor. So it really feels to me like Jack, and he seems to call Roy, Deputy Roy, quite a bit. It's kind of his go-to guy, and I definitely feel like there's a reason that the visitor and Deputy Roy are both played by Tom Carey. I think that there's definitely a reason they're the, you know, the same character, the same person. And so I think Jack may have called Roy, the visitor, and let them know how inquisitive Melissa's getting and that we need to do something about this. She's asking a lot of questions and probably getting too close to the truth. So they drug her. And, well, I hope they drug her, I'm pretty sure. You know, they didn't. Not trying to kill her, they're just trying to slow her down, stop her, and accomplish whatever goals they're looking for. So I don't know who this guy with the needle is. Clearly involved, but he doesn't look like, he looks like a you know, stereotypical bad guy. He's wearing an all black long sleeve shirt, you know. He looks like somebody you would hire to do some shady stuff. And so hopefully we'll find out some more about that guy in the future chapters. Well, if you have anything that you'd like to contribute to the analysis of any of the chapters, you can do so at itwantstogetout.tumblr.com. At the very top of the blog, there is both the Ask Me About Haunting Melissa and Dark Hearts and Submit Your Findings links. There you can send anything you like, pictures you found, just text or write up theories, things like that that you have. And also in the discussion board in the app. And in this chapter, there are quite a lot of interesting things in the discussion board. There's talk about, Monica's talking about some new things that she's noticed in the update for the app when that happened. And even going into stuff like in the window when Melissa is on the street confronting Caraway. There's some signs in one of the storefronts that say something about disaster planning or something like that. And Monica's making a correlation between the Astor in disaster and the Astor in Lancaster. And the abundance of the color teal in the chapter. Dead Airman 1 on Twitter's made a lot of correlations and with the color orange as it appears in the movie, so maybe there is something to the colors. It seems like every decision, well, everything that you see in Haunting Melissa and Dark Arts is for a reason. He talks about how she can't finish the Lord's Prayer in her truck, and the wind chime appears the symbols throughout. It's whispering in the chapter menu, is the Lord's Prayer being said backwards, maybe, and just kind of all over the place and trying to figure this whole thing out. So lots of really good insight there. Let's see, what else do we have? Let's see. IXCandyXI says that, guys, this whole scene was pre-chapter 9. This is before she went missing. They will show what happened when she was gone next and what they put inside her. So, once again, looking at timelines and trying to figure out when things happened. So, there's some questions inside of that comment about, you know, so are you saying that they're working backwards and showing us how she disappeared the first time? You know, so a lot of these ideas trying to put the pieces together before the, you know, next chapters come out. Willow Morning has a theory that this episode is pre-Melissa's missing. I think we're jumping back and forth, seeing her come home confused and not remembering where she's been. And Brandon looking for her. She's wearing black, and I think they drugged her to put it in her heart, in quotes. Hence the ATM scene of Haunting Melissa. Where she's wearing black, her face changes to evil, she walks away and disappears like the mom did. Bujuman73 is noticing some of the DSEs that pop up throughout, in the beginning, and two at the end. So there's a lot of talk on there. I mean, Monica's got another really long comment on there, and looking at all the little details from the chapter icons and everything that's in the story, both visually and auditory. So I hope you guys are out there doing the same thing, really picking this thing apart. You can get in contact with me on Twitter. My name is @apublicwitness, or the podcast has a Twitter as well. It's @adarkcompanion. You can listen to this podcast both through iTunes, your favorite podcast apps, as well as adarkcompanion.com. That's the Podomatic page. You can listen to all the chapters there. You can post comments. Please rate and review the podcast on iTunes. That's probably the most important place to do it. Let's everyone know how much you like it, and you can put comments in there, anything about the show that you like or maybe even dislike, and you know, I'll take all of that into consideration. On that Podomatic page, there is a PayPal link if you decide you'd like to contribute even a dollar to the podcast. That'll help keep it going. And coming soon, I've got some more special guests, some more people from the cast. So look forward to that. And thank you for listening. Have a great night.